Hi there, folks, and welcome to the Photo Wild Podcast.
I'm Annalise Kaler.
And I'm Jared Lloyd. We created the Photo Wild Podcast to blend together the art and science of wildlife photography. Each episode brings you stories from the field, from the technical considerations to the natural history of the subjects we work with. If you want to become a better wildlife photographer, then this is the podcast for you. All right, folks, welcome back to another episode of Photo Wild Podcast. Of course, my name is Jared Lloyd.
And I'm Annalise Kaler.
And we are your hosts for this episode and all episodes, of course, of Photo Wild. So the last time we met to do this, we talked all about our experience in Panama this year. And of course, this year, we did things a little bit differently. So, you know, for the past 10 years traveling to Panama, I have always gone to very specific locations, you know, specifically up on the north coast of Panama, out to the Bocas del Toro Archipelago, just for the extraordinary biological diversity. You know, that region up there is just truly unique. The Smithsonian actually kind of has nicknamed that place the Galapagos of the Caribbean, right? Because of the biological diversity, right? But Panama in and of itself, I mean, this whole place is just dripping with life and species. I mean, it's one of the biggest biological hotspots or biodiversity hotspots in the world. And where we happen to be, of course, up in the cloud forest is one of the truly unique places in all of Panama. And really, we can't say Panama, right? Like, I guess technically, when we talk about cloud forests, you know, anywhere throughout Central America, anywhere throughout South America, that these cloud forests exist, they harbor just an extraordinary array of different species. But I think when it comes to being a wildlife photographer and traveling to these locations, you cannot escape having some sort of experience, creating some sort of photographs, some diversity of photographs of hummingbirds. I mean, hummingbirds and cloud forests, they're kind of inextricable from each other, aren't they?
They are. And, you know, hummingbirds, of course, and you're going to get into this as well, is they're these specialists. And in this particular spot, you don't really have one without the other. And there's a lot of really cool history about hummingbirds. There's a lot of reasons that hummingbirds are where they are. But if you're going to a place in the tropics, if you're going to a place like Panama, hummingbirds are one of the crown jewel birds of the area that you want to photograph. And there's plenty.
I like that, crown jewel.
Yeah. Well, so many of them are jewels or gems,
oh,
I guess,
yes,
if you could say. So you have like these incredibly beautiful birds. And of course, they're absolutely enormous amounts of fun to photograph, you know, and the cloud forest, you know, you've got these beautiful sparkling sort of ribbons of moss dangling from the trees. You've got lichen-rich branches covered in branches. You've got all of these exceptional things that just draw hummingbirds in and make this area just a special place for them to live.
Well, and so first and foremost, I think it's important to state, right, because we actually have an international listenership, if that's a word, you know, with this show. And so I think it's important to state that hummingbirds actually only live in the Western Hemisphere, right? They can be found quite literally from Alaska, right? With it's the rufous hummingbird.
The rufous in southeastern Alaska.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, they actually nest as far north as Cordova and Valdez in the Prince William Sound. So you have from Alaska all the way down to Argentina, you have this technicolor rainbow. And I'm going to say technicolor rainbow because, I mean, gosh, anybody that's experienced hummingbirds, anybody that's photographed hummingbirds, of course, recognizes that it really is a rainbow when we photograph these guys. But they are throughout the Western Hemisphere, but they're not found anywhere else around in the world. And I think that people always love these sort of like hyper specialists, especially as photographers, right? Like even people that aren't really into bird photography, they love owls. Everybody loves owls. We did an entire show about owls and it was literally titled Everybody Loves Owls, right?
Yes.
Woodpeckers, that's another one, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, this hyper specialist, and of course, ironically, there actually happens to be the symbiosis between owls and woodpeckers, of course. But the third kind of group, family, whatever you want to call it, of birds out there that are just hyper specialists that live here are the hummingbirds. And again, they are just, to talk about the cloud forest, you know, it's just this environment, this area that we travel to is just absolutely inextricable from hummingbirds themselves. And I think that it's probably important to actually explain why that is, right? Because the cloud forests, as we talked about in the last show, cloud forests are really unique habitat types, right? It's not just about elevation. Just because you hit like, you know, say 6,000 to 8,000 feet or 6,000 to 9,000 feet in elevation, you know, means automatically you're going to have cloud forest. There's a lot of different things that have to kind of all come together, you know, to create this, you know, I don't know, I guess just really unique situation that allows for this habitat type to occur. But of all the places in the Western Hemisphere, it's actually the cloud forests that tend to harbor the highest diversity of hummingbirds. And so much of that actually has to do with the elevation and the temperatures of the cloud forest itself. Like we were talking about last time, you know, in the mornings up here, you know, 8,000 feet up in the mountains, that's kind of the average elevation that we were working. Mornings started in the low 40s and they made it up into the, about the mid to upper 60s. And that was, you know, when it was sunny. When it wasn't sunny, it was a little bit cooler than that. So always kind of like the weird thing for us humans, photographers, trying to pack and travel to places like this, because it's like, oh, we're going to the tropics where it's 95 degrees and 99% humidity down below. But really, we actually need, you know, jeans and hiking boots and jackets and a beanie and gloves and all that sort of stuff at times. We literally built a fire, you know, because it was so cool. But, you know, when you think about this, this is a truly, truly, truly unique situation for the tropics, because everywhere else it is hot, it is humid. And so to survive in the cloud forest means that there has to be some truly amazing cold adaptions with inside of these species. And so the reason that hummingbirds and cloud forests are just inextricable from each other, and I know I keep kind of harping on that word right there, but the reason that they're inextricable is because of those cool temperatures. So we think, and when I say we, I mean researchers, biologists, stuff like that, think that hummingbirds actually evolved within these cloud forests like this, specifically because insects were not a reliable pollinator for all of the different flowers. And so flowering plants, I should say, ultimately ended up co-opting these small species of swifts, which hummingbirds and swifts are in the same family with each other. And slowly but surely, they adapted, or they, I should say, radiated into all of the kind of many different species of hummingbirds that we have today. So it's literally the cool temperatures, these high elevations, that has led to this extraordinary diversity of these birds, just simply because insects are not able to handle those cooler temperatures, being an ectothermic species, meaning, of course, that they, you know, they regulate their body temperature from the external temperatures. Whereas birds, on the other hand, endothermic, warm-blooded, you know, they can handle these cooler temperatures in ways that insects can't.
Yes. And it's really interesting, too, because, you know, we also have, like, you know, bats, for example, who are specialist pollinators. Like, hummingbirds
Absolutely.
Are not the only specialist pollinators here. But because of that, you have all of these, to your point, amazing adaptations of hummingbirds. And you have this specialized area, you know, like 2.5%, just only 2.5% of the tropical forests are actually cloud forests. So that's really cool. This is a very special environment. It's a truly unique habitat that you're not going to always find. And so when you have this specialized habitat and you have this specialized species and you've got endemic flowers and you've got the beautiful orchids and you've got everything else that needs the attention of the pollinators, then, I mean, it opens up this whole new world of beautiful and interesting things to photograph as a wildlife photographer.
Well, and I think it's interesting, right? Like being a naturalist down in the tropics, like you and I can hike down a trail with, you know, lenses over our shoulders, and we can literally look at the flower itself and we can immediately tell whether or not it's pollinated by a hummingbird or pollinated by a bat, right?
Yep.
So like red and yellow flowers, for instance, in the, especially up in the cloud forest, these are pollinated by hummingbirds. In fact, if you think about it, like bees, insects, they're actually red-green colorblind. So, you know, they're kind of like a bear or a wolf, you know, they don't see the red. Mm-hmm. Now they see ultraviolet colors and stuff like that. But to go the length that it takes to create that kind of crimson red flower, for instance, you know, right off the bat, it's not for insects, you know? And then of course, also there's the shape of the flower itself. And then likewise with bats, you know, bats tend to be the pollinators of those kind of like upside down, pale yellow to white colored flowers, the ones that are specifically designed to where it allows for a bat to come swooping up and get that big mammal head stuffed up in there to actually drink from the nectar. So I don't know. It's one of the things I love about the tropics, right? Is because like the more we know, the better naturalists become, you know, extraordinary we become, you know, the more extraordinary the story is around us, you know, as we travel to these places. And I think I said this on the last episode, you know, it's almost like, you know, being down in the tropics, you know, it's almost like being on the frontiers of biology again. You know, it's kind of like being a 19th century naturalist in so many ways. In any case, like going back to the diversity, you know, the biological diversity of these hummingbirds, you know, in the cloud forests of Panama, you know, we talked a little bit about how that these islands essentially function like these kind of islands in the sky, right? You know, so while you have this mountain range, like the Talamancan mountain range, for instance, you know, that sweeps down from Costa Rica into Western Panama, and then of course, all around it, surrounded by lowland tropical rainforest. That means that a lot of the species, many, many, many different species that live up in these mountains are going to be endemic species. They're not going to be found anywhere else just simply because you don't have that, you know, corridor of connecting habitat to other mountain ranges in that sense. So cloud forests, when we talk about the biological diversity of Panama, and again, it's one of the most biologically diverse places in the world, you know, it's the cloud forests that really play a tremendous role in that sense. And with hummingbirds specifically, you know, Panama itself has close to 60 different species of hummingbirds. And I think it warrants just pausing for a second with that, because if we think about this 60 different species, that means 1/5 of all the hummingbirds in the world can be found in Panama, this one country that's smaller than South Carolina, the state of South Carolina. You know, and so again, we've got a family of birds that lives from Valdez, Alaska, all the way down to the southern tip of Argentina, and 1/5 all right here in this little teeny tiny snake-shaped, figure-esque curved, whatever you want to call it, sliver of land that is the land bridge between North and South America. And that's why you and I keep going back to Panama, of course. You know, there's a lot of places that we could go. There's a lot of places that we've been throughout the neotropics, of course. But it's this concept of the land bridge where you have North American species overlapping with South American species right here in this one spot. And it just, I don't know about you, but I'm kind of like a little kid in a candy store when I'm running around with 400 millimeter out there.
Yeah, it's kind of like, I don't want to say it's overwhelming by any means, but it's astonishing to see the diversity firsthand. And I know for me, you know, I'm hearing the little hummingbird, I always call it like little chitters that they make, you know, they make those little squeaky sounds, you know, I'm hearing them everywhere. And in some cases...
Is that the official like ornithological terminology there?
No, it's the anisological terminology. And that is, you know, I hear them doing their, you know, their squeaks and their chitters all over. And it's right in that sweet spot for my hearing. So it's exciting for me when I hear them because they're so loud and distinct every time you hear those hummingbirds coming in. So it's fun to try to spot them. And it's fun to kind of, you know, watch what they're doing and kind of figure out where they're perching. They're such creatures of habit on top of it. But, you know, you mentioned too, like you have this land bridge area. And I think for me that the habitat and the diversity of the habitat that comes through that area is what the big draw is, you know, I don't always have access to something like that. So like in this particular area, and I was kind of researching a little bit more about where this, you know, the forest kind of comes together with some of this in the area we were. And in that area, we have tropical lowlands, we've got the montane forest, we've got oak forests and cloud forests. And then even at higher altitudes, you even have some bogs and there's like a tropical alpine grassland up at higher elevations as well, right?
And you find those throughout the Andes especially, but just a little teeny tiny bit in Panama.
In Panama. And so when you think about all of that, like that habitat in and of itself, you'd be hard-pressed to find a lot of places in the U.S. the size is smaller than South Carolina, right? Where you have all of that diversity and all of that habitat, right? So when you think about that many different landscapes and you think about all of the animals and wildlife that call that home and have purpose-driven reasons for being there and keep those areas going, it's mind-blowing. And then to sit and immerse yourself in it takes it to the next level.
Yeah. And I think that, like, you know, speaking about that diversity, you know, where we spent the bulk of our time, you know, what was it like 15 different species of hummingbirds or something like that?
Yeah,
I mean, I don't know off the top of my head. I actually didn't count as I went through my photographs. But it's a pretty extraordinary number, especially when you compare it to, like, you know, if you're on the East Coast of the United States, you have one. You have the ruby-throated hummingbird, and that's it, which ironically, of course, the ruby three-throated hummingbird happened to be in Panama at the time that we were down there because they migrate down there in the wintertime. But it was this huge number. And for us, we were specifically interested in some of the rarities and endemics. Again, working inside of these cloud forests, a lot of diversity, but the endemics, the species that can be found nowhere else but these spots, was a big priority for us. And, you know, what was that? That was like the fiery-throated hummingbird. That was the Talamunkan hummingbird. And the, one of our favorites, the white-throated mountain gem. Now, of course, all three of these species, technically speaking, find in Costa Rica as well, right? Because it's the same chain of mountains. It's still the Talamunkan mountains there. So you go to, you go to places like Monte Verde, you know, in Costa Rica, there's a possibility of seeing some of these species there and everything. But one that, like, I had no idea about this. You actually educated me on the white-throated mountain gem. In my world, a white-throated mountain gem was a white-throated mountain gem, whether I was photographing them in Costa Rica or down in Panama. And you told me that actually wasn't the case, that this is a totally different species that we had in Panama.
Yeah, so we actually have it's kind of split into two different subspecies, right? And like you said, they call the same mountain range home. So it's, you're going to see a different version in Costa Rica in the same mountain range that you will see in Panama. So the Panamanian subspecies is the gray-tailed subspecies. And you'll see that they have this beautiful sort of color that you're used to, right? The beautiful blue crown and the white throat, et cetera. But the distinct difference is you'll see this gray tail on the back end of the white throat. A mountain gem. And then on the flip side in Costa Rica, you'll have kind of the same sort of look and feel, except they have a very vibrant blue-green crown, and then they have a green tail with a little blue band across the bottom. So they have some subtle colorations, right? And so I want to throw this out there as well. Even though we did not photograph the purple-throated mountain gem, they look very similar. In fact,
this is a different species, though. We're not talking about the white-throated now.
Right. We're not talking about the white-throated, but I want to point this out to our listeners, especially because I know a lot of them have been to Costa Rica. When you look at these two mountain gems, they look almost identical in so many ways, especially the females. And so if you are somebody who enjoys the, tropical birding and you're going to be in Costa Rica, or you might try, coming with us along to Panama, et cetera, I want to point that out so that you don't accidentally misidentify it and think that you found like a third species or you found something else, because there is some overlap in identifying those. But we primarily photographed the gray-tailed white-throated mountain gem.
That is a mouthful. Right there.
It is. I mean, birders, naming of birds is never just as simple as, bird A or bird B or one word. And of course, now we're getting ready to change about 80 different names of birds.
Oh gosh, that's right. Yeah.
So we'll have a whole onslaught of new names to learn, which I'm excited about. But yeah, in this case, we photographed the gray-tailed version, and you're not going to see this subspecies in Costa Rica. You're not going to see this subspecies anywhere else.
So
you're
truly endemic to where we were.
Exactly. Truly endemic to where we were. Endemic, of course, being geographically restricted and native to that area. So that's kind of the two components for those who aren't familiar with what we're talking about. And you'll only find them here. And then on the flip side, just right across over the other side of the mountain on the Costa Rican side, you'll have the other version with that green tail and that little blue band along the bottom. So they do have those subtle differences.
So basically, and this is kind of ironic then, right? Because where we were literally butted right up against, a national park, La Amistad National Park, that kind of spans both countries there, right? So what you're saying is that this is the dividing line, right? Like on one side is the jets, the other side is the sharks, basically,
sure.
With the white-throated mountain gems.
Yes, exactly. And it's kind of an appropriate reference too, because these small little hummingbirds, the other hummingbird in there, the violet saber wing, is a 15 centimeters large, like huge hummingbird.
15 centimeters does not sound big, but when you're set up to photograph those little white-throated mountain gems, and then all of a sudden a saber wing comes in and it's like, oh, great. Like there's no tail. There's no wings.
Yeah.
I've got to move back 15 feet to be able to get this whole bird in there.
Yeah. And so like the violet saber wing is very large for a hummingbird, right? They have a very noticeable size difference. But the white-throated mountain gem, speaking of jets and sharks, right? They are fierce about their territory.
Yeah.
They are one of the few species that will take on the saber wing, which is also a very territorial species, even though they're like half the size, and they often win.
Well, so what we saw is they always won. That was the mind mind-blowing thing about it, right? Because we had the violet saber wings, which for anybody that doesn't know what a lot of these species look like, and we recognize that these are some pretty exotic names that we're using right now. But there will be photos on the Photo Wild website and everything where you can see these in the show notes and stuff like that. But these guys are huge, right? And then we also, with the Talamunkan hummingbirds, you know, these guys are massive hummingbirds as well. And then you have the little teeny tiny diminutive, you know, white-throated mountain gem that is just charging in there, flushing everybody out, you know, they're like guarding the flower all to themselves. And I mean, I personally found that to be one of the most interesting facets of it. And while, you know, it kind of makes sense, right? Because, I promise I am not going to attempt to pronounce the name, right? Because not only is it not a language I don't know, it's not even Spanish, but the Aztec god of war was always represented or usually represented as a hummingbird for this reason, because even the Aztecs, you know, kind of really, you know, put these species on a pedestal and recognize just how fierce and how territorial, you know, and, you know, what scrappers they are. So that's something that I found really fascinating, right? The Aztec god of war is a hummingbird, essentially, right? And then you're sitting there watching this little dude, you know, come in and, like, you know, kick all of the bigger hummingbirds out of there. And it's like, okay, yeah, I totally get it. That is the god of war right there.
So, Jared, you brought up a little bit ago the Smithsonian Tropical Research Institute. And I think this is interesting because they've actually been putting out some research as it relates to territorialism and hummingbirds specifically. So Jay Falk, who was a pre-doctoral fellow studying at STRI, and he also did some work for Cornell, I might add, he studied the white-necked Jacobin, which, of course—
One of the lowland species.
Lowland species. So we weren't photographing at this point, but the research that he was doing is what kind of led to some of these new theories about who decides what hummingbird territory is more exciting or who gets attacked by other species versus who has to defend constantly. Why do they fight and who do they fight, right? So he was doing his research and he discovered that some of the young, non-sexually mature females were harassed less and allowed to feed longer because they weren't as vibrantly colored as some of the females, so that were more mature. So when you have these breeding pairs or you have these territorial hummingbirds, what he started to notice that his research panned out was that when you have a female species that is more colorful and hasn't fully matured yet, etc., the males tended to go after the duller females and treat the other brighter young females as if they weren't competitors. And we don't necessarily know why that
is. Wait. So you're saying that the dull colored, obviously older females, the males were attacking?
They were pushing them out.
But they allowed for the smaller, younger, brightly colored females
correct.
To stay around. Okay.
Yes, they noticed the difference. And the idea behind it was that the younger, brighter females weren't sexually mature yet. They didn't need to be showboated for. They weren't trying to impress those females because they weren't ready to breed anyway. All right, so on the other side of the spectrum, we have another species that we photographed heavily in the same area, and that was the green-crowned brilliant. And that is also a species native to Panama, not entirely endemic or anything like that, but found throughout the cloud forest area of Panama. And they are very distinctively calm.
So endemic to Panama, just not specifically these mountains we are in, is what
correct.
You're saying. Okay.
Actually, no. I take that back. Not endemic to Panama. They're native to Panama.
Okay, there you go.
So they're native to Panama, and they're very distinctly calm with their presence. And we kind of saw this as we were working with these hummingbirds too. You know, compared to most hummingbirds, they aren't nearly as protective. They're not nearly as feisty with the food sources. They are willing to wait for the other hummingbirds to finish before they swoop in to the flower and try to enjoy the nectar while not being harassed by a white-throated mountain gem or a saber wing coming in there. And one of the things that's also interesting with the species, and part of what I suspect is playing into their calm demeanor, is they also happen to be insect specialists. So a lot of people think of hummingbirds as only, you know, across the board, as only these nectar drinking species that all they do is eat from flowers and sip this nectar, and that's what they do. And they
we as photographers don't help that, do we?
Right.
Because we always depict these species as drinking from flowers.
Right.
And so I think that only helps with that
It does. It definitely, I mean, that's what almost all of us think about, right? Even at feeders or how they come in and how most of us see hummingbirds in our yards, etc. But insects actually make up to 60% of hummingbird diets. They don't just need sugar like us. They also need a mix of protein in there. So insects are a very important part of hummingbird diets. And in particular, the green brilliant likes to work that mid-story all the way up to the overstory part of the canopy for the specific insects that do withstand these cooler temperatures of the cloud forest. You do have some insect life up there. They're not always down low, kind of where we tend to think of and photograph these birds, but we do have some insects up in that high overstory, and that is where the green brilliant really tends to shine, is that they get a lot of their food and their protein from the insects up in the top of the canopy. So I suspect that that's part of the reason that they have adapted to do that is because there are other territorial species in this habitat that are already fighting for a lot of the flowers. And if you are a small little, you know, green brilliant, and you are trying to survive in between all of these other territorial species, and that's not really your jam, I can see them going up to that overstory and really working some of those higher elevation, you know, orchids and air plants and the insects up there, and then coming back down to some of those mid-story dripping, beautiful blankets of pink flowers and the other things that we saw there, but with a little bit less to compete with.
It's kind of like Darwin's finches in a way, right, is what you're saying. Like, or, you know, if anybody's ever read the book, Beak of the Finch, you know, where you basically have these little species that kind of adapt to all of these various ecological niches, right? And like one happens to be filled by one species and that species becomes territorial and protective of its food source. And so, you know, you have this kind of adaptive radiation or speciation that ends up, you know, shifting other species to other ecological niches, essentially, is what
exactly.
You're saying.
Yeah. And so...
So you, fascinating.
Yeah. And, you think about how these small animals have to survive in such a huge space. So there's a lot of specialization, and of course, cloud forests just lend themselves well to species like hummingbirds who do specialize, who do have these qualities that are unique to them, who are the pollinators of the cloud forest, who are completing these tasks for the rest of Mother Nature and what she's relying on them to do. And so having like these, these territorial competitive species along with some of these calmer, more laid back species that have a little bit more diversity and they're not so defensive, it really plays well together, and you can see how they can coexist much more easily by having those different specialities.
And I think that actually plays into the way that we end up ultimately photographing hummingbirds in a lot of ways. If we can kind of, move over into the photography here for a minute.
Yeah.
Like you and I have talked about this numerous times, right? You know, what life is really like in the wild, you know, with a 400 millimeter or a 600 millimeter thrown over your shoulder with your boots laced up and kind of hiking up through the forest looking for wildlife. And when I say that, I mean specifically in the tropics, whether it's the lowland tropics, whether it's in the foothills, or you said the montane forest or the cloud forest or whatever, you know, mm-hmm. I mean, it's like coming to the tropics, first and foremost, it's complete and total biological overwhelm. I mean, just truly
in
overwhelming.
The best way.
Oh, in the absolute best way. But what it also means is that like it's actually extraordinarily difficult to see a lot of the stuff there is to see in the tropics. I remember many, many years ago, like, you know, we were in the kind of the pre-production stage with a BBC documentary, and you know, I was talking with the producer, and as I was trying to explain what the situations were going to be like, I remember her just pausing and be like, you know, Jared, this sounds like an absolute nightmare to me. You know, trying to bring a film crew in there and set up and film this sort of stuff, you know? And that's something that we experience on some level every single time we go to the tropics, you know? So where we were this year, you know, after we kind of left the cloud forest area that we were photographing in, you know, we ended up, it is a whole other long, crazy story of getting kind of like stuck in Panama for a couple weeks and stuff. And that's, like I said, that's a different story for a different time. But, you know, we did have access to a couple, you know, small little hiking trails at, kind of Volcanburu National Park that we were able to, you know, do some hiking and stuff like that, since we couldn't really leave the area. And we saw hummingbirds. We absolutely saw hummingbirds.
And
we'd hike up there, and it was absolutely beautiful. And it's thick, just once again, biological overwhelm, you know, multi-storied canopies, basically,
mm-hmm.
within this, you know, kind of primary forest, these old growth, you know, cloud forests and stuff like that. And when you saw a bird, when you saw a hummingbird, it was always the same situation. You know, we would hear this, like, the buzz, right, the hum, or we would hear, what did you call it, the chitters? The chittering of them, right? And then it's like, all of a sudden, we're like spinning around in circles. Like, okay, I heard that. Where did it come from? And again, remember, you know, this is, you know, we're in deep, dark, dank cloud forest, mm-hmm. rainforest, right? And so, you know, it's dark in there. You know, it's like there's so much going on. And we're spinning around, trying to find where this sound came from. And then all of a sudden, there it is, 50 feet up in the tree, we find like this vine of red to pink flowers dangling down and this nondescript, who knows what the species was, because all it is a silhouette up there. Basically, it's there feeding at a flower and then it's instantly gone. That's it.
Yeah.
And gone, gone. Not like, let's go land in a tree someplace and hang out and let's come. No, this is a species that, you know, first and foremost, the metabolism of these birds are so high that at any given moment, they are no more than 15 to 20 minutes away from starvation. You know, so they're hitting one flower and then buzzing to another flower and then bouncing to another place. And so the probability of walking through a forest like this and actually, you know, stepping up to, you know, one of these beautiful kind of vine-like flowers hanging from the trees and having a bird come up to there and feeding off that, it's next to nothing. I mean, it's truly next to nothing.
It
is. It's probably like the most challenging and difficult photography you'll ever experience in your life. Forget about trying to find caribou up on the tundra, you know, in the Arctic. Forget about trying to hunt down a snowy owl's nest or something like that. You know, forget about sitting on a rocking boat, you know, trying to photograph, you know, puffins flying at 60 miles an hour. That's all a piece of cake when it comes to actually trying to get on one of these tropical species of hummingbirds that's actually in the wild, not fake wild.
Yeah, absolutely. And even, I was going to say, like, even when we were walking along, the birds that were at eye level, you know, obviously I'm a bird nerd. I love my birds. I absolutely am quick to identify. If you've ever been out on a trip with me, whether it's been a bird guiding trip or a photography workshop, you know that when I see a species, I'm always calling out like the field marks so that other people can instantly start to recognize some of these things. And as these birds were coming through, even at eye level, even being what I would say is a highly experienced birder that I am, it was nearly impossible to grab even one field mark or even one simple thing that would allow me to ID the bird. And that's just like, to your point, the low light of it, but the speed, and that was at eye level, sometimes from just a few feet away, they would just be so fast and they would dart around so much that it was truly almost next to impossible to see and identify the birds, let alone what would happen if I tried to swing my lens up and take a photograph of one. So to your point, wild sightings of hummingbirds, I get excited every time I do see one in the wild simply because it's so exciting to see them, but it's just not a very efficient way to try and photograph in the wild like this. And also, you know, like you could set your camera up on a tripod and stand at one set of flowers all day and hope that you are fast enough to, you know, hit your shutter when a bird comes and flies in. But I don't know a lot of wildlife photographers who would be willing to do something like that simply to try to have a photo of a hummingbird at one of these places.
It's important, I think, to differentiate the fact that we're talking about the tropics here. You know, we're not talking about the temperate latitudes. We're not talking about ruby-throated hummingbirds coming up to a field of flowers to feed or something like that. One of the big misconceptions for a lot of people, you know, for the first time coming down to the tropics, you know, they hear about, you know, all of these different species of birds, all these different species of, well, just basically everything, right? But there's a tremendous difference between diversity and abundance, right?
Yes.
So while in the United States, for instance, you know, we may have this sweeping field of natural field or meadow of flowers, native flowers, all that sort of stuff, that you have this kind of like, you know, just never-ending brain of ruby-throated hummingbirds, you know, again, just to use this one species as an example, coming into feed. That is a situation where somebody can actually walk out into those meadows and you can capture truly, truly wild natural situations with these birds. Down in the tropics, totally different. While we may have extraordinary biological diversity, you have to understand that diversity is not the same as abundance. You know, you may only see this one species this one time and that's it. And so let's say, you know, we're hiking through the woods and we look up and there's that violet saber wing that's 25 feet above our heads feeding from that, you know, that native vine essentially, and then it flies off and it's gone. Well, stand around for 45 minutes to an hour. There's a very, very, very good chance you're never going to see another bird fly to that one flower. They're off looking for something that falls with inside of that same family, most likely to feed on, and there's just not going to be a large abundance of it.
Right.
So yeah, I think that's important to state. And so that's why it is truly so different down here in the tropics, down here, while we sit in Alaska, of course.
coming out of a blizzard, no less.
Right, coming out of a blizzard, no less. That's why it's so different down there. I think, you know, one of the many reasons. And so what that means is basically, you know, when we think about hummingbird photography, there's two ways to do it, right? There's the natural photography, like just truly natural photography. And then there's ultimately some sort of setup situation. And I would argue that even with a lot of the air quotes here for, you know, I know nobody can see what I'm doing, of course, for the quote unquote natural hummingbird photography that occurs down in the tropics, I would say 99.9% of that, of those images that you see, ultimately come from somebody wandering around the gardens of a lodge, basically. And those gardens are filled with all of these brightly colored, beautiful, absolutely positively non-native species from South Africa, like the birds of paradise, or, you know, Asia, like the Asian ginger, for instance, that are planted there because we see them and they're like, oh, look, tropical flowers. And they're bright and they're colorful and they'll attract other birds in, like hummingbirds and stuff like that, to feed out of it. But there's nothing really natural about this. You know, this is still a highly manicured situation, walking around those, like I said, those gardens at lodges throughout the tropics. So yeah, I mean, really truly natural hummingbird photography in the tropics is throwing that tripod over your shoulder or that lens, you know, over your shoulder or whatever, and then hiking up through the woods and that 1 in 1 million opportunity to happen to be there at a flower that a hummingbird actually came into. So that means that what we end up with are setups. And while you and I don't do a lot of setup photography, when we're down in the tropics and specifically when we're working with hummingbirds, that is truly one of the situations that we do setup photography, because it is really the only way that you're going to be able to see and photograph these species.
I think it's really important for a lot of people who aren't familiar with setup photography to kind of break it down and explain a little bit about what that is first. So setup photography is essentially the idea that you're creating an outdoor photo studio for these hummingbirds, right? So a lot of times what you'll have is you'll have some feeders around just like you would at home. You've got all these hummingbirds that are acclimated to the feeders. You know, you're not just going to put it out for 10 minutes and then have all these birds rush in and suddenly you've created a bird studio. That's not how it works. These are, you know, very habitual creatures. Hummingbirds are especially pattern oriented. They like to fly and perch to and from the same spot. They often go to the exact same place on the feeder. They often will come back into always like the third flower bloom up on a vine. They're just very, very habitual birds.
Even though it might take them 4 hours to come back to that third flower
exactly.
Up on that vine.
But, or if they're going to another plant, it'll also be that third flower.
Yes.
You know, they're just very, very pattern oriented. So the feeders have to be up for a while. So the place that we were photographing, you know, these hummingbirds are accustomed to coming into the feeders. They're very habitualized to the idea that there are feeders here. And that's what most bird studios are. You know, a lot of times you'll see people in the backyard. It's where if they're setting up their bird studios here in the U.S., you'll see things like, you know, there's going to be a bird bath. There's going to be, you know, bird seed feeders. You're going to have mealworms out. You're going to have suet, all of the things that attract birds to the place. You want to photograph them.
I did we just published a feature article in Photo Wild magazine this summer all about, you know, kind of creating the ultimate backyard bird photography haven like that.
Yeah. And I think what's interesting, and I just want to point this out as like a side note, and to your point about like wandering around the gardens, then these gardens happen to be these non-native sort of selections of flowers. You know, for me, whenever I'm looking at bird photos and I see people doing setups a lot, one of my true big pet peeves is when I see them doing setup photography and I see birds with mealworms, dry mealworms in their mouths, because for me, that's the dead giveaway that this is a setup in there, because you're never going to see a bird in the wild who's just like finding dried mealworms all around the yard, unless it's a feeder, right?
It's like 90% of the eastern bluebird photos are like that, right?
Yes. And so that is just a caveat I wanted to put out there. It's one of those little things that every time I see one of those photos, there's a little grate in my brain that's like, I hate that.
But it's absolutely relevant to what we're talking about here.
It
because
is.
Even though you and I were doing these setups, right? And we've done setups before with hummingbirds, it's always so critically important for us to actually find, to do the research first and foremost, do our homework and find at this particular time of year, in this particular location, with these particular subjects, these particular species, I should say, what are the very particular species of flowers that they're feeding off of, right?
Exactly.
And so for you and I think that becomes such a critical part of the story. Now, let's be honest, right? You and I actually make a living selling our photography, right? So, you know, our intentions when we're in the field may be a little bit different than other people's, right? For some people, it's like, oh, look, it's a very beautiful yellow flower, you know, the South African bird of paradise, you know, that they happen to be, you know, that they have. It's a gorgeous looking little flower. It's perfect for the hummingbirds to come into and feed out of and stuff like that. And so all they're excited about is like, colorful flower, and then there's a hummingbird. So you and I, it's a little bit different. I'm not going to be able to sell a photograph of a South African flower with an endemic species of hummingbird that's only found in this, like, you know, 25-kilometer area yeah. of Western Panama in this one particular province. You know what I mean? That's just not going to happen. That doesn't make any sense. So for us, even though these are setups, right, you know, the details matter because let's face it, that's all there ever is just details,
yeah.
you know, and it's so important to get this part right for us.
Absolutely. And, you know, I talk all the time about those incremental things that make you a better photographer. Most of the time, it has very little to do with your gear and it has a lot more to do with your level of detail and your level of paying attention to the things that make a photo truly like a fact check. This could be very real type of photo. And this is one of those, like, you want to use flowers that are things that these hummingbirds are going to normally be feeding on in this time. And while the birds of paradise, some of these other beautiful plants are indeed beautiful and they're photogenic and they're wonderful. If you and I had that in our portfolio, like a photo editor would never give us the time of day. They'd think we don't know what we're doing, but we see that kind of stuff time and time again.
So, oh, I think it's like, I mean, I'm going to go out on a limb. I know it sounds hyperbolic. I would say it's 99% of the stuff. You know, I mentioned the poison dart frogs earlier. You know, it's like you look online, you do a search, you see it on Facebook. 99% of the photos of poison dart frogs are on non-native species that, you know, are not from that area, that don't even grow in this hemisphere, you know, but they're just chosen by, you know, these tropical lodges, you know, these eco lodges, because they're pretty and that's it. And then they're chosen a lot of times by photographers because, like, well, that's a complementary color with that colored poison dart frog. And so from an artistic perspective, they jive, but from a storytelling perspective, from the ability to actually sell that work other than, say, a print on a wall, it doesn't fly, unfortunately.
Yeah, and I think this also ties back to some conservation elements as well, which is, you know, a lot of times people will ask things about, like, you know, with habitat loss, how can I help the wildlife? How can I do these things? How can I do that, those things? And anybody who's ever had more than a 10-minute conversation with me will hear me talk about the importance of native plants. And the best thing that you can do for the wildlife in your area, the birds in your area, the other animals in your area, there are two huge things. And the first one is going to be plant more native plants. Plant the plants that are designed to live in the area you are, because they are designed to also feed and coexist with the species that are in the area you are. And there's no reason that anybody needs to plant non-native anymore. There are a lot of beautiful, beautiful native alternatives to many of the non-native species. And the other one, of course, is leaving the leaves, which is another entire episode. You know, you want to leave the leaves so that the insects can overwinter in the yard and that you've got plenty of bird food and plenty of other things. But that's why these native plants are so important in our photographs, is they really perpetuate what it should be like for our bird friends and our wildlife friends. And if you want to have your work looked at and taken, I don't want to say taken seriously, you can still create beautiful photos those other ways.
Yeah,
but
for sure.
It's like, why go through all of the effort to only have sort of something that's incongruent going on in the frame, like a disharmony to the whole situation? So I think, like, our efforts to put in the native species that are seasonally appropriate, that are appropriate for the species that we're photographing, that are appropriate for the area that we're in, and all of those extra details are why those photographs have so much more impact than the other way around. And I think it's just all that whole picture coming together in harmony and not having one of those pieces out of place that would make it be either less sellable or less impactful.
Yeah, absolutely. And so what that ended up doing for us in Panama, it may have resulted in, you know, somebody scaling a tree and, you know, and clipping this one little piece of vine for us, you know, so that way we could keep that story correct. You know, that way we could play to the actual natural history of those subjects that we are photographing. So even though they were setups, we are still using these very unique, and oftentimes, especially with that vine that I'm talking about, right? That was an endemic species. It doesn't even have a common name, right? It doesn't exist. It's only a Latin name. And forgive me, I'm not going to attempt to pronounce it. You know, I'm pretty good with Latin, but, you know, sometimes when it gets to be like 12 syllables, not so much, kind of like the Aztec god of war. All of that was done on purpose. It was specifically because here we are, we're photographing this, you know, these truly unique endemic species that only live here. And a couple of these species happen to be feeding from this truly unique endemic species of flower that only lives here as well. So obviously that's what we want. But, you know, when we talk about setups, I think it's important to at least kind of paint a little bit of a picture of what that actually looks like. Now, when you and I sat down to kind of try and figure out what this show was going to look like, sound like, all that sort of stuff, the 800-pound gorilla in the room, if you will, is it 800-pound gorilla or is it the elephant in the room?
Either.
Either? Both work? Okay. The 200-pound hummingbird in the room was, you know, do we actually, you know, kind of begin to dive down the rabbit hole of talking about flash, right? But we both decided that the type of flash photography that we're doing in these setups is a little bit complicated to try and explain in the context of a podcast or through the medium of a podcast. That's one of those things that's best, you know, kind of shown in person or with diagrams and stuff like
video,
that. Because
yeah.
Video, yeah, exactly. You know, and the reason being is that this isn't one flash. It's not two flashes. It's not three flashes. It's anywhere between four and five different flashes that we're actually setting up to work with these birds, essentially. So when we talk about setups, understand we're working with an endemic species or a native species of flower or plant, right? First and foremost, we have that kind of held up by a tripod or a light stand, essentially. And then we have a multitude of different flashes set up around that as well. We have flashes coming in from behind to create this nice edge of light, basically to kind of define the characteristics and the shape of the birds. We have what's called a key light. That's our primary light coming in, you know, above and off to like a 45-degree angle from the bird. Then we have a fill flash light that's coming in. Then we'll have, you know, lights that are hitting backgrounds and stuff like that, right? So, you know, it's a pretty complicated setup. And so oftentimes I think it's more appropriate to actually think of these things, not so much as setups, but as outdoor studios in that regards, because, you know, you've done a significant amount of commercial work and, you know, with people photographing presidents and heads of state and all that sort of stuff, you know, and so it's those sort of situations where people are typically working with key lights and fill flash and, you know, backlighting and all this other stuff.
Yeah. And it's interesting. So we did a combination of both too. We did have a natural light studio setup as well that
we
worked
did.
With.
Absolutely.
And then we had sort of the other setup. So I just wanted to throw that out there saying, you know, a lot of people think that you have to use flash on this, and
no,
you certainly can
by no
for
means.
some techniques, but you can also do, you know, this sort of studio photography with your natural light also. And so it can get complicated. It doesn't have to be. Once you learn it, it's another technique that you have in your toolbox to kind of to try different things. And I know, Jared, like you did some super cool artful stuff with flash and the hummingbirds. And
Are you talking about with the white backgrounds?
Yeah, with like creating a little bit of a different studio setup style.
Yeah, we literally dragged a huge white backdrop to set up behind one of these things.
Yeah, so there's a lot of options with it. But I think when you're creating a setup and you've got your natural studio and, you know, the flash can certainly help in some instances. The important part here is that you're just creating an opportunity for your subject, in this case, any of the hummingbirds, to come into this area to be photographed. And we're basically, I guess you could say, luring them in the sense of, you know, this is an area that has a lot of feeders around it. These birds are acclimated to coming into the feeders on a daily basis. So they're very used to it. And then what happens is these birds have been coming in, and then slowly the number of feeders gets like reduced, and you've got the flower, the native food source that they're going to feed off of anyway.
Yeah,
you've got
that replaces the feeders.
That replaces the feeders. And then these birds see that flower and they get all excited and they come on in. And as they're sipping, you know, from the nectar from the petals and inside of the bloom, you know, then that's when we're photographing them, is as they come in and as they're drinking and as they leave. And so it's a very natural experience for the bird as well. And so, of course, after we're kind of working through it, the feeders go back up and things, you know, continue on. But that's kind of the gist of how these setups sort of work. You know, the feeders are there. They diminish in number. The birds come into their natural food source, and that's when we get our beautiful photographs.
Yes. And once again, that's another reason as to why we don't like to use the non-native stuff. And I mean, even the lodges that were like the lodges that we work with and the particular area that's, you know, up in the cloud forest, it's one of the things I truly like about working with these guys is because of their insistence on only working with native species.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they don't have all of these crazy, you know, Asian, African, every other tropical places around the world species,
yeah, no,
you know, growing everywhere.
Yeah, they're dedicated to keeping everything as native as possible there. And that's a really important factor. And I think, you know, again, it's just one of those small details. If you're going to the effort of creating a studio, then go to the effort of creating a studio that's actually promoting the story of the species you're going to photograph, and that it's actually a food source that they would naturally experience in that season, at that time, in that place, to fully tell the story. So it's so worth the extra effort.
It really, truly is. You know, it not only does it elevate the photograph, you know, nerds like us, bio nerds like us, well, you know, you'll obviously, you know, get a hat tip from us, you know what I mean? A thumbs up for that sort of stuff. But yeah, I mean, if you're somebody that is actually interested in ever selling your work, these details matter so much. I mean, just so much, you know, yeah. It's like a lot of images that we see promoted around the world, you know, by other photographers, they work great for selling workshops and stuff like that. But they don't work so great for selling to magazines, for selling stock photography and things like that. And so if that's something that you're interested in, keep it native.
Yeah,
keep
I'd say the same. I know a lot of our listeners and a lot of wildlife photographers enter contests. It wasn't that long ago that I was judging a contest for a camera club and the bird category came up. And right off the bat, I eliminated about 10 photos simply because the bird was holding a dry mealworm or a sunflower seed or something that just, while not necessarily wrong, it was such a jarring removal from reality in their setup that it just didn't do the species justice. Or I have seen, like to your point, almost everything are these non-native plants, and it's just a little bit, you know, of a discord there. So you want to be mindful of knowing these things as a naturalist and as a photographer, because there are people out there. If you're selling your work, if you're entering these contests, if you're trying to get noticed in some way, if you're trying to break into the business in any way, those are like instant killers of those images for people like us who look at these things on a regular basis or judging contests or you know, kind of going around and teaching. Those are some of those primary factors that we're going to notice immediately right out of the gate, just like judges and photo editors would.
Absolutely. And one of the other thing I think with the setups to mention here, you said that there's multiple ways of doing the setups, right? We can use natural light and we can use flash. Mm-hmm. And I think that you and I both really prefer that natural light look and feel, because all we're ever doing with the flash is trying to recreate what natural light looks like.
Yes.
Now, not every situation lends itself to being able to do this, you know, with natural light. Again, one of the reasons that we like working in this location is because it does lend itself to that natural light photography as well. But I think specifically from the perspective of a workshop itself, right? The thing that I love about being able to do the multi-flash setups like this with the hummingbirds, because it creates the perfect teachable situation, you know, for clients on these trips to truly learn
yes.
flash. I think, like, you know, when people come on these things and they see how all this comes together, you know, it really does in so many ways become kind of like a master class on flash. You know, people show up with, you know, zero experience a lot of times with this sort of stuff and walk away with a pretty solid understanding of how, like, one flash does this. I can add two flashes for this. I can get really creative and add another flash for that. I can create black backgrounds. I can create natural backgrounds. I can create these bright white high key, you know, style photography in the background. That's just, I always think of them as, you know, kind of being very fine art looking and, you know, almost of a meet your neighbor sort of perspective with that whole kind of style and class of photography and everything.
Yeah, I think with flash, like I hear this all the time too, is just like, oh, I just hate flash. It's so obvious. And I was like, well, then you've seen flash work that isn't good.
Yeah.
So like flash should never be so obvious that, you know, it's not like back in the day when we would have our photo taken and we've got red eye, right? Like you'd see on the disposable cameras
yeah.
that people hand out at weddings
the party
and everything.
Photos.
Right. So, you know, you used to see all those differences and, you know, it's just not good flash work. So the point with flash is not to make it look, you want it to look like it's natural. It should have somebody questioning whether or not flash was even used, because it should be so subtle and
Bingo.
Well done. And so that is the goal with flash photography. And people learn in a variety of different ways. There's a lot of different places you can learn about flash. I will say that you can read about the inverse square law all day long. You can read all the technical jargon.
Boring.
You can try to make your way through it. It isn't until you start putting it into practice and you have some hands-on experience that you start to say, like, oh, really? That's it? And I think that's one of the things about flash that most people don't get. And I think about, like, to your point, I've done a lot of, you know, corporate work and editorial work and studio stuff where I've used a lot of different lighting setups and I've done a lot of different light modifiers and a lot of different sort of scenarios where bouncing light becomes a big factor, et cetera. And it's actually a lot of fun.
Oh, it's immense amount of fun.
And a lot of people are really scared of it. Now, I would never use like flash with an owl, for example. I'm not somebody who uses flash in wildlife photography, except on the rare occasion I do a setup like this specifically. But learning flash as a photographer is a lot of fun and it can really add some new elements to how you see even without flash. So I'm a big proponent of saying, you know, as photographers, it's important for us to step outside our comfort zone, not because it's going to necessarily teach us a new skill or a new thing that we can put into it, but it's going to teach us a lot about the way we already shoot too. So there's benefits on both sides. So I like to think of it kind of as an exploration, a couple ways you're going to learn a whole lot of new skills. And I think our workshop setup is the best place for that because it's hands-on. You get immediate tangible results. You get immediate, you know, coaching on how to fix something. You get to see immediately how this plays in, and it kind of bridges that mind-reality connection with how Flash works. But then you also have what you learn from that situation that you can take back into your natural light photography too, because you start to see, how does light bounce? How does light resolve on this method? And you'll start to see that pop out in just the way you read light. And as photographers, we are nothing if not recorders and readers of light.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, for me, flash is a tool, right?
Yep.
And it's, you know, photography is all about, you know, writing with light, recording light. That's all it is. You know, I think you already said that. But yeah, flash is another tool. Most people are scared to death of it. They shouldn't be. There are times and places where I think that it's absolutely a fantastic artistic tool that we can utilize to elevate our photography, to truly take our, you know, our photography to whole new levels. And when we're working in these dark places, when we're working with small subjects, when we're working in deep, dark forests and stuff like that, flash absolutely has a place, you know, that can be, you know, brought into the craft of photography. And yeah, you know, it's with the workshop, you know, obviously we do the natural light setups, we do flash setups, we do black backgrounds, white backgrounds, natural backgrounds, you know, all of that sort of stuff, and teach folks, you know, exactly how that they can do that themselves. And then of course, it's ultimately up to them to decide which style of photography do they ultimately like the most. And, but the at the end of the day, at least after this, they know exactly how to do whichever style of photography that is, with flash or without.
Yeah. And I think you actually hit on something that I want to just revisit, which is like the black background idea. And a lot of people, so this has come up the last three talks that I've done to different camera clubs about wildlife photography. This has come up in every single one, which is, how do you get the black background? So this came up most recently because somebody was like tired of painting it in. And I was like, how that works.
Don't do
right?
That.
So, but it, a lot of people don't realize that is that with a flash at 12 o'clock noon in the direct sun with no cloud cover, no nothing, with flash, I can make a background completely black. And that's something that you can do as a photographer when you understand how to control that light. So if that's something of interest, like this is where those sort of advanced techniques come in with this kind of a tool that with flash is like understanding how you can create that in camera, understanding how you can make some of these interesting choices in camera. So these are really fun. And like you said, you know, this is applicable. You go home, you can start doing it in your backyard right away.
Definitely. I would like to just, I think there, like just a disclaimer, one thing about what you said with the black backgrounds, because that comes out a lot or comes up a lot. And
it
we
does.
Get emails on a regular basis about this. People ask us about it on workshops and stuff like that. You know, yes, you can absolutely positively create that beautiful black background with a single flash, even at noon. 99% of the photography that you see of larger animals, let's say, you know, a great egret, a bear, you know, whatever, there's no flash being used.
Right.
That's understanding the dynamic range of your camera and how to work with the
yes.
natural lighting situation. There's nothing, we don't, you know, like as an artist, like, you know, I've got some recognition in terms of like using that chiaroscuro style lighting. You know, I work with black backgrounds on a regular basis. But, you know, at the end of the year, honestly, I probably create 10 images, you know, with those sort of beautiful black backgrounds. And it's just because to actually find that in the wild, it's so rare. But with these smaller subjects, you know, when you're working with a poison dart frog, for instance, or you're working with a hummingbird at a setup, then yeah, absolutely. You can very easily create those black backgrounds. But yeah, for anything larger than that, we're not using flash, you know, to be able to do that. Could you? Yeah. If you're Joel Satori and you're working, you know, on the what is it, photo arc that he's got going on, he's working with captive animals and he's photographing every single species on Earth in these studio settings, 100%. Absolutely. That's what he does. You know what I mean? But, you know, a black bear in the wild, you know, we're not setting up multiple flashes. We're not setting off-camera flashes to be able to pop this corner of the bear with a little bit of light and then underexpose four stops in camera to get a black background.
And I'm not standing on the side being like, okay, cue the bear, please.
Right. Nobody runs over there with the little handheld light meter, you know, to get the incident light reading off of the bear or anything
that's what
like
we'll,
that.
That's what we'll tell the next person who says, can I carry your bags if you just let me come with you? I'm going to be like, you're in charge of light metering the bear.
That's right. Yes. You have to go and stand next to the polar bear and record the light that's falling on the polar bear's face. So that way we don't overexpose our highlights.
I kid. I wouldn't do that to any of you.
Are you sure?
Okay, maybe two or three.
Maybe two or three? Okay, fair enough. All right, well, so guys, thanks so much for joining us on this this episode of the Photo Wild podcast. You know, we really got into the weeds, of course, as we tend to do.
It's what we do.
Or as we always do, I guess I should say. Yeah, so I think this is probably going to be our last episode in regards to like CloudForce and Panama and all that sort of stuff for the year. You know, ironically, we were in Panama for basically a month, but just because of unique situations and stuff like that, we only got about a week worth of photography. And from here, life changes dramatically. In fact, I still have to finish packing and I fly out at 2:55 in the morning.
That's right.
Tomorrow morning to start prepping for the Yellowstone workshop and all that good stuff.
Yeah. And I'm not far behind. So we'll have a month in Yellowstone. We've got a quick stop in Kentucky for Imaging USA. And then it's
Which is the big convention that PPA is doing. And Annalise is one of the speakers there this year.
I am. And there's a couple of other wildlife talks too. Yep. Which is exciting because, you know, this is kind of a new avenue PPA is trying to go into.
Yes.
And then it's back up here. You've got Epic Eagles coming hot on the heels
of
this.
We have Epic Eagles,
yes. We do. And it's a lot to process with all the travel and everything else. But we've got a lot of good episodes coming up on the podcast. And thank you so much for listening. We're so glad you decided we're worth your time. And if you'd like to leave us a review, we're always appreciative of that too.
Well, folks, that's a wrap for this episode. Thank you so much for joining us.
You can always find us at photowildmagazine.com. And we really look forward to answering your questions. So send those in at info@photowildmagazine.com. I'm Annalise Kaler.
And I'm Jared Lloyd. See you next time.